Thank you, Neil. Thank you for the opportunity to give this talk, and thanks for having me here. So I'd like to discuss some, or very subjectively as I see them, some current challenges in large-scale structured theory and data analysis. And this is, I'm going to present the slides, which are mostly based on works done in collaboration with Oliver Philcox, who is a PhD student at Princeton, also Anton Chudaikin, who should start his postdoc appointment at McMaster University, I believe, very soon, and Marko Simonovic, who is a group leader at CERN, and Matias Zadariaga, who is faculty at Princeton. And also, there were many other people who contributed, and you can see them here on my slide. So, my talk, let me see if it works. Okay, so my talk will be devoted to three particular topics. First of all, I'm going to review the current progress in measuring cosmological parameters from the Bose survey and also some implications for future surveys like Euclid and DAISY. Then I'll discuss some current challenges, some current things I'm working on regarding large-scale structure, which are the bispectrum, post-reconstructed BEO analysis, and also the covariance matrices. And then at the end of the my talk, I will discuss some progress in the theoretical description of the council cell statistics and whether it can be used in data analysis on the same footing as power spectrum, bispectrum, and other conventional probes. All right, so let me first start with the full shape analysis of the galaxy power spectrum. So I noticed that there were several talks already at Princeton given by Marko Simonovic and Oliver Philcox and also Jay Vadakkar. So I think I'm gonna skip a lot of things that Mark and others have mentioned. So let me just briefly say that most of our current understanding of cosmology has come from the measurements of the CMB, and I think that operationally it's very clear what is being done. So we have very precise, exquisite measurements of the temperature and polarization fluctuations by Planck collaboration, by ACT and others. And then we also have some infrastructure, some theoretical infrastructure, Boltzmann codes like CLASS or CAMP that produce the theoretical templates for the observed spectra. And then we do the MCMC fit. And in the end, we get some nice blobs that tell you the current constraints on cosmological parameters, right? And a very similar program can be done also in the context of the galaxy power spectrum, because we have pretty similar measurements of what we call the redshift space galaxy power spectrum. Essentially, this is the two-point correlation function of the density field. And thanks to redshift space distortions, we also get to observe the velocity fluctuations that are manifest along the line of sight. So they act as some noise that contaminate the redshift measurement and alter the mapping between the distances and redshift that we use. Well, anyway, here on this plot, I'm showing you the what is called the monopole power spectrum, which is the essentially spherically average version of the redshift space galaxy power spectrum. And you should really think of it as a density auto spectrum, density two-point correlation function. And then the quadrupole is the cross correlation between velocity and density that you get to measure by looking at the clustering along the line of sight and combining it with other clusterings. So essentially you can do this very similar program. Yeah, you can compute this power spectra as a function of cosmological parameters. Of course, the problem is that you need to take into account some nonlinearities, and I'm going to talk more in detail about that. And then you should also be able to get the cosmological constraints from your MCMC. And I think that the main advantage of large-scale structure is that, in fact, you observe this galaxy distribution in a 3D volume. So, in fact, you have many spectra like that at different redshifts. And potentially, it will give you more modes, more observables, so more, just statistically, more information that you would get from CMB. And that's why this motivates the current and future large-scale structure measurements. So this program of measuring cosmology from large scale structure, I think that was initiated long ago. Yeah, there is a famous paper by Max Tegmark, but I think that even before him, in the times of Peebles, I mean, it was already realized that these curves, they depend on cosmological parameters in a specific way. And the first analysis by the Bose collaboration, SDSS, they were done in this way. Some class, I think back in this, there was only CAMP, I think that, or CMBFAST rather. So yeah, the first analysis of the Bose data was done in this full shape manner. Then I think that somehow this research program stopped, and somehow most of the analysis focused on the BEO signs. And now, like after, I guess, a decade or so, now we're trying to revive these full shape measurements. But compared to what was done before, now we have more advanced tools. And using these tools, we have built a new pipeline that can, with which you can analyze the large-scale structure measurement in this full shape manner. So this pipeline essentially, yeah, the main idea behind this pipeline is to consistently recompute the whole shape of the power spectrum in a CMB style SQRE cosmology using the most advanced nonlinear perturbation theory model, and then perform the full MCMC. So every single time in the MCMC, we evaluate the power spectrum for a given step in cosmological parameter space. And then this was possible thanks to recent progress in numerical methods that allowed for fast evaluations of the so-called perturbation theory loop integrals. And then we have put all these ingredients together in a code called class PT, which you can easily interface with common samplers like Monty Python or Kabaya. And yeah, we hope that this code is user-friendly and it can be easily run by anyone. So also we just have put online several tutorials that allow you to take a look at the output of the code and essentially make it all the way to the parameter constraints. All right, so the core idea, the core method of our code is to use perturbation theory, right? So why perturbation theory is good, or rather the effective field theory, I'm gonna be talking about this, say, particular variation. It's just because it's built on some robust theoretical principles, and it starts the description all the way from the microscopic level. So it starts at the level of the Boltzmann equation, and then you average them and so on and so forth. And I noticed that Oliver Philcox had already given a very nice overview of this. So I'm just gonna say that, yeah, all these things have been done. And there are different flavors of perturbation theory, Eulerian, Lagrangian. Also, there is one that we put forward with Sergei Sibirkov, TSPT. Is just a different way of organizing the same perturbative expansion, essentially. And what's good about perturbation theory is that it allows one to quickly compute the theoretical templates for a given cosmology. And this is exactly what we want for our MCMC. And then also it's a very natural setup to marginalize over the somewhat like nuisance parameters that capture uncertainty in our modeling, because of course, not all the things that you can compute, you can predict accurately, because we know that in a linear evolution and various phenomena, say relevant for Gaussian information, they're very complicated. So yeah, it's hard to describe them, but on large scales, they all simplify and can be captured by a number of nuisance parameters, which are called counter terms and bias parameters. So this is all very good. So still we need to make sure that this perturbation theory works. And I'm gonna present you two different tests. One of them will be tested at the level of summary statistics, which I call PT challenge. And the other one is tested at the field level. So let me first start with the PT challenge. So Marco has already presented this work. So when the work on the pipeline was finalized, we participated in a blind challenge organized by Takahira Takada and Takahira Nishimisha, along also with other group, our friends led by Leonardo Sinatore. So the task was to measure the unknown cosmological parameter parameters from high resolution body simulations whose total volume was 600 gigaparsecs over H, which is something like 100 times bigger than BOSS or 10 times bigger than future surveys like DAISY. So essentially we're able to extract the unbiased cosmology from these simulations. And I noticed that you asked many questions. You asked Marka, like, if he's sure that the simulations are good at this level. And I think that in this regard, it's important to say that when we fit the simulations, it's not only the test of our theory model, it's also the test of the simulations themselves. Because how else would you check the accuracy of your simulations? On large scales, they should, at least in theory, they should reproduce linear theory, right? Then on intermediate, mild nonlinear scales, they should overlap with the regime of validity of perturbation theory. So hence, they should match perturbation theory on a certain range of scales. And if the two coincide, so if you can fit the simulations with your perturbation theory module and everything is fine, the chi-square is good, and so on and so forth, then it seems that the answer is both simulations are good and perturbation theory is okay. So you have match from both sides. And
question here.
Yeah.
Is there an implicit marginalization over nuisance parameters in this plot?
Yes. Also, we had to optimize nuisance parameters to produce this plot. Yeah, that's right.
And do you have like a rough estimate of the effect on the uncertainty when you marginalize over those parameters?
Oh, right. Yeah. I think that we do lose quite a bit of constraining power. So the constraints, the error bars become twice bigger as a result of marginalization over these parameters. So right now here, we're not using tight priors. So essentially we're using like very loose priors or no priors on this nuisance parameters. But in principle, I think that a good option would be to, in fact, like measure those parameters from simulations and get some nice constraints. Yeah, so the answer is that, yeah, we do lose quite a bit of constraining power as a result of this marginalization.
Okay. Thanks.
So can I ask another question? So when you say 0.5% accuracy in cosmology, what do you mean exactly 0.5% on what?
Well, it's a on each node, on the parameters that you didn't know, sigma 8. So we recovered sigma 8 with 0.5% accuracy.
Okay, it's a measurement of sigma 8 at 0.5%.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks.
All right. So then another test that you can think of, another test of perturbation theory. All right. Yes. Sorry. Before going to another test, let me just show you. Let me just say that we use this PT challenge to set the data cuts in our BOSS analysis. So we essentially observed zero bias up to Kmax 0.15. And then, of course, we're using the first approximation of perturbation theory, the so-called one loop correction, first order. Of course, there are higher order corrections that are missing. And we have seen some evidence for them. So at higher Kmaxes, the fit becomes biased, but still the bias is much smaller than the error bar of our measurement, and it's beneficial to go to higher case and find some balance between the statistical and systematic error. So in the end, our analysis are done, I think at scale 0.25, even more, even shorter scale than what is shown here. All right, so another test of perturbation theory is the field level comparison, because in principle, perturbation theory predicts the whole density field, and which, in other words, it's not only the power spectrum, the density field is equivalent to all possible correlation functions, it's the bias spectrum, tri-spectrum, and so on and so forth. And a very similar comparison at the field level have been done for dark matter and halos, and now we're doing it for halos and galaxies in ratio space. And here maybe I should also say that one good point about really comparing the perturbation theory calculations at the field level is that you don't need to pay the price of cosmic variance, which means that you can achieve very high, you can provide very strict test of perturbation theory from relatively small box simulations this way. So here you can see the result of simulations for halos and ratio space, then the ratio space bias model in the middle panel, and then the residual between the two, and we find a very good agreement between them. So I think that this test, this high resolution, like feeds to high resolution simulation, and the field level comparison, they provide some evidence that perturbation theory works, at least on some range of scales, and it can be used hence for to analyze the data. So we have applied our pipeline to the reanalysis of the publicly available Bose data. Of course, this analysis is model dependent, so we need to assume a model. So we assumed Lambda CDM, and essentially, we just did the full MCMC scan of the Lambda CDM parameters directly from the shape of the galaxy power spectrum. And then we had to assume one external prior, which was the BBN prior on omega baryons. And our theory model, so we're fitting the remaining parameters of Lambda CDM. And also our fit included seven nuisance parameters that parameterize, that characterize the linear and nonlinear biasing, as well as ratio space distortions. So in the end, we have obtained the following optimal values for the remaining cosmological parameters. Some of them, I guess, like already appeared in the context of Flaschke structure, like omega matter and sigma 8, but some of them were measured for the first time, like the power spectrum tilt, or the primordial amplitude of the scalar fluctuations, or for instance, the Hubble constant H naught. So of course, these constraints were obtained in this very conservative setup where we're using only the BBN prior. If you were to impose, for instance, the Planck prior on NES, we see that it's pretty loose. If we were to impose, it's like something like 10 times looser than the current Planck prior. So if we fix NS to Planck, then of course all our measurements are going to significantly improve. Well, a few comments about this analysis is that, first of all, it did not include the selection bias, which was recently detected by Neil, also Will Percival, and Andrei Obolian. And it's very important, I think, that it's important to think about this effect right now and also in the future. Then that we have explicitly assumed Lambda CDM. So we did all forward modeling within this model. And this might be, this should be kept in mind. Then, we use this BBN prior. In principle, you can remove it and still you can obtain interesting constraints on the remaining cosmological parameters, for instance, H naught. And I think that Blake Sherman gave a talk at some point about this, that this provides you with the, in the context of Bose, this can give you the H naught measurement that doesn't use any input from the sound horizon. So you measure it from the quality scale effectively. Then we can supplement our analysis with additional data sets. We can add the post-reconstructed BEO measurements, and those are going to sharpen the parameter constraints, especially on H naught. And of course, it's possible to extend this analysis to the scenario beyond Lambda CDM, for instance, to include the non-zero special curvature of the universe or dynamical dark energy. Maybe finally, yes, Matthew?
Yeah, so in your last slide, just the previous one, with the contours.
Yes.
Just for context, like how different would things look if I just use like halo fit and the galaxy bias with like a K-square dependence marginalization? Like, you know, if I did something really simple, would I get like smaller error bars and then a relative bias relative to your analysis? Maybe that's too open-ended a question.
Yeah, you would. Yeah, if you use halo fit at K max, I think that at K max 0.1, then you would, first of all, you would get extremely bad chi-square. So you'd have some biased measurements with very tiny error bars. For instance, H naught would be biased because H naught we extract in the Bose mostly from the BO wiggles, and halo fit doesn't accurately capture the BO wiggles at all.
Okay, so you've actually checked this on simulations and...
The most simplistic things, like linear theory was not good even for Bose data analysis 1, and halo fit maybe was already failing Bose data analysis, like Bose year 2 or year 3 data release. Yeah, so these simplistic models do not work.
Okay, yeah, that's really useful context. Thanks.
All right. Yeah, just my final remark was that some of the results were also independently obtained by our friends from Stanford, led by Leonardo Senatore and collaborators. So where all this information came, let me just briefly...
Can I ask you something? So what was the difference between your analysis or your method and the one from Senatore's group?
I think that ideologically it's very similar. The difference was only... well, first of all, some technical realization because they were using different codes, different stuff. The second difference was that they were using slightly different data samples. Mm. So we're using the official boss, they were using something different. But I think that conceptually it's very similar. So the analysis is based on the same theoretical ideas, like to use the EFT, to use the most recent perturbation theory analysis, yeah. And to do the full shape analysis scanning over all relevant cosmological nuisance parameters. So yeah, there were only minor technical differences.
Okay, thanks.
All right, so, right, where all this information came from, I think it's important to say that our power spectrum, the linear matter power spectrum, which is C2 structure formation, that is formed at redshift 1000, then, well, you can take a look at it here. It has many features. It has the peak and has some slope. Also, it has a tilt, which is not degenerate with the slope. And all these like spectral features, they all depend on the what we call the shape parameters in the context of the CMB, like omega baryons, omega CDM, little omega baryons. So you should think of this little omega as really like rho, the physical densities. So omega baryons, omega CDM, and NS. So they control the shape regardless of any distance information, regardless of any projection effects. Then when we observe these features on the sky in angular scales, and from the theory side, we need to locate them, we need to project them onto the sky to be able to compare it with data, and then we need to define some distances. And in the context of the matter power spectrum, the best measured distance is the so-called volume average distance dv. So in lambda CDM, in principle, it depends on H naught and omega matter. But in lambda CDM, like omega matter is already fixed by the shape, so that the distance gives you directly H naught. And then other parameters, like the amplitude parameters, f sigma 8, or rather sigma 8, because in lambda CDM, f is fixed by omega matter. So you get it from the amplitude of the power spectrum. And then another effect, which is, I think, is in general very important, which is the Al-Kapuscinski effect that allows you to measure independently the distances along the line of sight and orthogonal, well, transverse to line of sight. In the context of lambda CDM, it doesn't give you new information, but of course, it's important when you consider the extensions of the basic scenario. Just maybe one last thing I wanted to point out is that there is this baryonic step, which is like one of the features which is not often mentioned in the literature. And in principle, it allows you to measure the, this is the suppression of the matter power spectrum due to the free streaming of baryons before they fully couple to dark matter gravitationally. And it produces this step-like feature, very similar to what we're used to seeing in the context of neutrinos. It's very similar physics. And this feature you can use to constrain omega baryons in principle, just, okay. All right, so I think that this analysis of both was mostly our preparation for future surveys. Which are expected to give us very precise information, maybe more precise than what we have with BOSS. And we have already ran a sensitivity forecast with Anton Chudaykin for future surveys like Euclid and DAISY. And the key idea of this forecast was to try to be as realistic as possible. So what if you gave me data right now and we would analyze it with the tools that are currently used? So we did the full MCMC of the MOOC data corresponding to the Euclid specification using the same pipeline, full nonlinear model, having marginalized over all the nuisance parameters and using the same data cuts as we have now. And we have found that even in this quite conservative case, we're able to detect the neutrino masses, even the minimal neutrino masses whose existence is guaranteed by neutrino oscillations can be probed at 5 sigma. when you combine the measurements of the galaxy power spectrum, bispectrum, and Planck. So here you can see also the breakdown of these measurements. You can see the contribution of the power spectrum alone. You can see that the bispectrum sharpens the constraints by 40% or so. And of course, you massively break degeneracies when you combine everything with Planck. And another aspect, which I think is important to mention, is that the future data by Euclid will be important also to improve constraints on the classical parameters like omega CDM and H naught, because the degeneracy orientations that are produced by large structure data are orthogonal to the ones existing in the CMB. So by combining the future measurements with the CMB, we'll be able to improve the constraints by, well, orders of magnitude on these standard parameters. All right, let me switch to the part of my talk and discuss some of the topics I'm currently working on. Yes, Matthew?
Sorry again. So do you have a rough idea of how much the neutrino mass constraint from just the power spectrum compares to a case where you didn't use your EFT? Like, you know, you mentioned that the error bars go up a little bit, right?
You mean from the power spectrum?
Well, I'm just trying to, many of these surveys have like forecasted how well they'll do with neutrino mass from the power spectrum. I just want to understand like how that changes given that there's this marginalization of the nuisance parameters.
I think it's pretty similar. So there is a little bit of compensation. So on the one hand, EFT allows you to go to higher key maxes, compared to the forecast based on linear theory.
Right.
But then you need to pay this price by marginalizing your parameters. And the amplitude effects, at least at the level of the forecast, they seem to compensate more or less one another. Mm-hmm. So using EFT, we'll be able to get to the numbers that are also forecasted with linear theory. Cool. But I think it's good to know this, to have run this forecast, because now at least it could have been the other way around, right? It could have been that you would lose all the information because mm-hmm. it's marginalized. I think that it's nice that this didn't happen. It was not guaranteed.
Cool.
All right. Let me discuss several current challenges, some of the things I'm working on, some of the improvements of this full shape pipeline. So let me first start with the bispectrum. So why the bispectrum is worth doing? Well, first of all, showed you the constraints on neutrinos from future surveys. And here I'm kind of just plotting the PDF for neutrino masses more explicitly. So you can see that the addition of the bispectrum will sharpen the neutrino mass measurements from future surveys. And that's why just practically it's very good to use it. Then I think that the basic theoretical properties of the bispectrum are already known. For instance, we know the three-level theory is finalized. Yeah, it's available, the formula is there. Then infrared resummation, or in other words, the description of the nonlinear evolution of the BO wiggles in the bispectrum also are present in the literature. And some data compression techniques, which are super important, as well as some factorization properties. For instance, it's clear that the pi spectrum is factorizable on large scales, and then the treatment can be simplified. So it's not some arbitrary function of free wave numbers. It's just, the product of free functions, and this property is very important to use. The pi spectrum, on the other hand, is much more challenging than the power spectrum in the technical sense, because first of all, you need to very accurately take into account the binning or the finite width of the bins, which was not the case for the power spectrum. And then you also need to implement this correct infrared resummation routine, because otherwise, even for things like BOS, like without these two first steps, you would get massively biased, which is, for instance, not the case for the power spectrum, which is kind of more forgiving for some little technical inaccuracies. Then the treatment of the survey mask is more challenging. And of course, another change is that the bispectrum presents a very large data vector with many entries, something like in the BOS context, the data vector has 2000 entries. So it's just hard to operate with this large massive of information. So then of course, there are more things to do, like implementing the analytical covariance calculation. So I'm going to discuss it in detail soon. And then it would be nice, of course, to compute the one loop and to be able to evaluate it quickly such that this can be used in CMC analysis. All right, so I'm working right now on this bispectrum likelihood, and so far I'm at the level of the comparison with mock catalogs for both, and it seems that it's true. Even the three-level bispectrum works as expected, and it sharpens the cosmological constraints by something like 30%. Well, for some parameters, it can be even bigger. For instance, for σ8 in the plane σ8b1, it narrows the posterior by a factor of two or so. So here, I think it's very promising. All right, another.
Can I ask, so you mentioned just now, you know, that the bispectrum is less forgiving of certain of these technical aspects like binning, for example. Why is that? Yeah. Is there some simple, you know, reason why that's the case?
Yeah, why binning is more important.
For example.
Well, I guess it has to do with this, you know, with having many triangles, and in principle, for instance, you can imagine the situation that binning changes the number of triangles that fall. Like when you change the bin size, you'll have a different number of triangles.
Sure, like, but for the power spectrum, if you change the bin size, you'll have a different number of pairs. I mean, like, you know, it seems straightforward to include.
I feel like part of it might also be the steepness of the bispectrum as a function of k. At least at tree level, the bispectrum is like power spectrum squared. So the power spectrum is more smoothly varying as a function of k. So if you bin, you don't make as much of a mistake across the bin, whereas the bispectrum, it's worse.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense.
Right, yeah, this could be, yeah, sorry, I don't have a good answer, but I think, yeah, this explanation, yeah, this explanation makes a lot of sense. Okay, thank you. all right, yeah, another important observable is the posterior constructed BEO, which I think was one of the main observables of so far. So we know that there is this procedure of BEO reconstruction, which allows you to sharpen the BEO oscillations. Well, in Fourier space, you would get a bigger amplitude of this harmonic oscillations. In position space, you can think of reconstruction as like sharpening the BEO peak. And this is a fully like data-driven procedure, and it's hard to describe it theoretically. And I think that, to a certain extent, if we are to marginalize over the broadband information, which is typically done, then the remaining part, like the reconstructed power spectrum, can be expanded just, you know, the wiggly part of the power spectrum that has all the wiggles times some exponential damping. And this model worked pretty well for previous Bose analysis. But we have checked that for the future service, like DAISY, the error bars will become so small, so this treatment might not be accurate anymore. And for instance, here I'm showing you some posterior that we extracted from the speedy challenge simulations. Like we also did the BEO reconstruction on these catalogs, and you can see that the standard, the naive model, it gives you very biased constraints. And of course, we know that at certain level of precision, well, here we're talking something like about 1% or 0.1% precision. Things like the shift of the BEO peak, generated by nonlinearities, and also some details, some like particular shape of the post-reconstructed BEO wiggles, they are not captured anymore by the simplistic model, and we're working on improving this model. Also, there were some works in this direction, and for instance, by Zvonimir Vlach, collaborators. Now we're trying to improve them by carrying out this calculation directly in the Eulerian framework. But I think that it's important to like realize that this BEO treatment needs to be improved if we are to realize the potential of future BEO measurements. All right, maybe one last thing is the covariance matrix treatment. I'm going to discuss well, alternatives to the standard covariance matrices, or in other words, how to extract accurate parameters with very few mocks, or even without them, because the standard approach to covariance matrices is to run many mock catalogs and to just measure the covariance matrix using the standard empirical, like high school estimator, right? Like P minus P bar times P minus P bar 1 over minus 1. All right, so, but this standard empirical estimator requires many mocks to be computed in order for your covariance matrix to be accurate, and which might be computationally very expensive. And I think that Jay Vadeka recently gave a talk about this, that with Raman Skachimara, they had put forward a new analytic approach for the covariance matrix that includes all the effects that are important for the actual data, like the window function, and also they had computed the trispectrum, which is the connected part of the power spectrum covariance. And in the end, this calculation can be done very quickly. And in principle, it produces the same, very same constraints as the full like mock-based covariance. So I guess that in the future, this approach will be very useful. But you can imagine that there are situations where it's hard to obtain analytic it's hard to carry out analytic calculation right now. For instance, one of the example is the bispectrum. Again, yeah, one of the reasons that bispectrum is such a large data vector, it has 2000 entries. So you would want to at least to have 2000 mock catalogs to be able to estimate. But if you want to be able to estimate the just analytic covariance such that it's invertible, and still it will be very noisy. So you need much more than 2000 mock catalogs for accurate covariance metrics. And I think that both what they ended up doing in their bispectrum analysis, they had increased the size of the binning just such that they have like less data points, and now they can extract the covariance with the available 2000 mocks. But I think that this leads to like to a loss of information, and it's best to work on data covariances. So keeping an eye on this problem, we had proposed a new method of data compression, which we call the subspace projection. And this method of data compression is based on a very simple idea. So I guess that you're all familiar with the signal-to-noise ratio. So for the power spectrum, it will be given just by P squared times the inverse covariance matrix. So this gives you the total signal that is contained in the power spectrum. So this is a quadratic form. In principle, you can diagonalize this covariance matrix, and you can rewrite this a signal to noise sum. Like once you have rotated in the new orthogonal basis, you can just write as a sum of some eigenvalues times the rotated spectra. And then you can approximate your signal to noise with a smaller number of eigenvalues. And for instance, you can say that, oh, I'm going to use instead of n bins, which is 100, I'm going to use 10 bins that carry the bulk of the signal to noise. But this idea is not good in general for the following reason, that there are some parameters that are not directly related to signal to noise or contribute very little to signal to noise, but still are important. The example is the BEO, because we know that the BEO feature is relatively small, something like 5% of the matter power spectrum. So it contributes very little to the signal to noise, but then it dominates the distance information. So we would want also to retain the BEO feature. So in order to get around, we propose a generalization of this procedure, which is based on the singular value decomposition. It works very simply. We create the so-called template bank. So we sample something like 10 to the 5 cosmological parameters, and then compute, we create 10 to the 5 sets of cosmological parameters and nuisance parameters, and then we compute the power spectra for every single set. And then we compute the effective chi-square of these templates, the set of templates is called the template bank. So it just essentially, for every single template, we're computing its chi-square with respect to the mean template averaged over the bank, and then we sum them up. And then we can do a little bit of algebra, and we can rewrite this in a manifestly diagonal way, such that the effective chi-square will be just a sum over the bank, then over the bins, and then inside the bin sum, there will be only like a sum over these x's, which are like diagonal vectors that can be obtained from, okay, from your templates times some fiducial covariance that doesn't need to be the data covariance. All right, but then the idea is that now this new x is some tensor that lives both in the bin space and in the bank, template bank space, some tensor. And this tensor can be singular value decomposed using the standard formulas. And then this decomposition in principle can be cut at a certain number of singular values. So we can use less singular values than n bins. And if we use as a criteria, say the chi-square itself. So we say that we want to keep only those singular values that capture the bulk of the effective chi-square. So only those singular values that contribute up to say delta chi-square 0.1. Then we're gonna find out that we only need, like for both, we only need something like 12 singular values to approximate the template bank. And hence we can use this projection from full space of n bins only onto these 12 singular values. And this way effectively we're performing analysis only with 12 values but those are 12 values that matter the most that carry the bulk of the signal that we're interested in. So this subspace projection technique allows us to compress the whole bispectrum data, sorry, the power spectrum data vector that consists of 100 bins into a 12 bin, new 12 bin vector of subspace projections. And for 12 numbers, you can use you can estimate the covariance pretty efficiently, even if you have something like 100 more catalogs. And the improvement, like the effect of this compression for the bispectrum is even more impressive because you can substitute 2000 bispectrum triangle bins only with 9 singular values, which in principle carry all the signal that you want. And then of course it will, we check that for Euclid and DESI, essentially this method will require, like this projection will require, even though the data, the error bars will become smaller, the number of singular values will be pretty much the same.
So for each cosmological parameter, you'll have like a different like set of 12 dominant modes, right?
Yeah, that's right. Well, in principle, we expect that these modes, I mean, we look at them as something like the first mode is the amplitude of the power spectrum, the second mode is the BEO, the third mode is some generalized like shape, template, and so on and so forth. So they all have some meaning in terms of the power spectrum templates.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they can all be interpreted. But is it clear that this is saving you? I mean, so if you have like 10 parameters, and then each one has like a order 10 of these modes you have to use, then in the end, don't you still have to, compute like a similar number of mocks or no?
Oh, no. Here is at 12 parameters for everything, for all the parameters, including all the parameters, cosmological parameters that we want. So we can replace, in other words, this Bose analysis can be only done at the level of 12 numbers.
Huh, okay. It sounds like magic. Okay, I'll have to ask you more about this.
But on the other hand, we know that, for instance, we cannot measure 20 cosmological parameters, right? If we keep, throwing an omega curvature and things like this, at some point we'll stop measuring them. They will be very degenerate and our constraints will not be good. So we have 12, say, principal directions that are measured very well. So let's focus on the...
Okay, I see. Okay, so I should think of this kind of like a PCA in some sense.
In some sense, yes. So in principle, you have, if you use 100, then it's the same. But if you use only... 12, then you capture the bulk of them. So you only focus on things that you can measure well, in other words.
Okay, sure. Okay, yeah, sorry.
But these directions, so are they the same for all experiments or how you treat them for all data that you have? But now you have a new survey with, using something else, maybe say 21 centimeter or something else will come. So that those directions will change or not?
100%, yeah, they will change.
Okay, I see. So this is done for Galaxy servers.
Yeah, this is done for Galaxy server, but very similar technique you can use for any other experiment. Yeah, that's right.
Doesn't it depend on what you had in your template bank? If your template bank didn't have variations of neutrino mass, for example, then you wouldn't project to a subspace that.
Yeah, it's also important that your template bank also samples all the parameters that you're interested in. Yeah, for instance, imagine there is some parameter that produces very specific shape distortions, like, you know, neutrino mass or, say, the early dark energy. Then it's important that you also sample this parameter in your template bank. Yeah, that's right. But I guess, yeah, the good point about this is that for a given model, like, you need to create this template bank only once. In fact, it's very fast. It takes only maybe a couple of hours. But it will save you much more, especially when you analyze the bispectrum. And I mean, you will be able, first of all, to analyze the bispectrum with this number of bins, which you're not able to do otherwise because you don't have enough mocks to build the covariance. I think that another good application of this method is that, yeah, indeed, it allows you to build the accurate covariance for a very small number of mocks. So here, we had done some tests for the power spectrum. On the left, I'm showing you the contour plots that were obtained from the analysis of the power spectrum with the covariance matrix created from 100 mock catalogs and from the whole set of 2000 mock catalogs. And you see that if you're using a small number of mock catalogs, then you have a lot of sampling noise. And the sampling noise acts like some additional source of stochasticity. And in principle, it shifts, you know, your optimal parameters around. And as well, Percival and collaborators have shown, you need to account for this effect and you need to apply a certain multiplicative factor. Otherwise, you will get biased. So we had applied this factor. And here you can see that the constraint obtained for 125 mocks are like twice looser than what you would get with a full amount of mocks. But on the other hand, if you apply the subspace projection technique, then even 100 mocks are perfectly fine. And they're giving you the nice posterior contour, which doesn't change if you keep improving the covariance matrix. So yeah, we had shown this for the power spectrum, but for the bispectrum, we expect that this technique will be super useful. All right, so in the dying minutes of my talk, let me now discuss the third topic, which is the non-perturbative calculation of the count itself PDF. And that is work done in collaboration with Sergey Sibirikov and Alexander Kaurov. So this is going to be mostly, you know, about theory. So the counter cell statistics is, I guess, the first ever observable in large-scale structure cosmology. It was measured by Eden Hubble in 1934. So it's very simple ideologically. You just observe distribution of galaxies. You throw randomly spheres with a given radius, and then you measure the number of galaxies in every single sphere. And then you plot a histogram, how many spheres with a given number of galaxies you have. And then, yeah, this sounds pretty simple. Then it's very surprising that this observable was like accurately studied only recently. And yeah, I think that from the theory point of view, it's pretty clear what we want to compute. Yeah, first of all, let's go into the continuous limit. So instead of counting number of galaxies, let's study the density field. Then want to know what's the probability that a cell of a given radius R star contains some average density contrast delta star. And then the calculation that answers this question is very similar, in fact, to the calculation of the tunneling probability in quantum mechanics. And the relevant parameter here is the smoothed density field, the smooth on the scale of the cell, and it plays a role very similar to the H bar in the quantum mechanics calculation. So the answer to this question, the PDF that I'm going to show you, will be presented in very like similar in a very simple form that makes it that makes connection to the quantum mechanics. So it will be some exponent of one minus H bar times A naught, which is the saddle point solution or instanton, if you will. And then there will be some corrections to this leading exponential expression. And these corrections will be coming from the fluctuations on top of the spherical collapse background, most importantly, the aspherical fluctuations. So in fact, the calculation of these corrections is the kind of main achievement of our work. So from the theory point of view, we can, the relevant quantity that computes the PDF is the path integral in terms of the linear density field. So here we need to do the integral over all initial states weighted with the Gaussian weight. We know that linear theory and the linear theory of is Gaussian. Then times the delta function that selects only those states that eventually produce the target density delta star. So here this delta W is some functional, it's just the spherically averaged. So you need to forward evolve your delta linear and then spherically averaged, and then it should match the target density. Then you count, and then you divide it, this, the number of cells, compute this way by the total number of cells. It's pretty simple. So then it can be shown that this PDF has a spherically symmetric exponential saddle point. So it has a very simple form, similar to what we're used to see, say, in the pressure vector calculations. It will, the numerator will depend on the spherical collapse mapping between the linear density field and the nonlinear one, the target density, delta linear. So delta linear is a function of delta star squared here, divided over the smoothed variance of the density field, smoothed over the on the Lagrangian size of the cell. So essentially this spherical saddle point tells you that the most likely configuration, if you observe some average density delta star, it's most likely that it originated from a cell whose radius was R star, and then initial density was delta linear, and then it evolved purely under spherical collapse. That's it. Then, of course, okay, this is a linear order result, and we need to calculate corrections on top of this result. And for this, we have to expand our density field into the spherical and aspherical contributions. So the spherical corrections we can easily compute because we have the spherical collapse model, which is a great model that is valid beyond the perfect fluid approximation, all the way until shell crossing. So the spherical fluctuations all can be taken into account, but then we need to compute this aspherical corrections, and they're going to contribute into the pre-exponential factor, and we call them the aspherical prefactor. So the point that the final PDF should be expressed in the following form. It should be some spherical part that you extract from spherical collapse times the spherical prefactor. So this is the first prediction of our model. And we can take a look at the embodied data and get convinced that indeed this is what happens. The spherical PDF captures the exponential fall off of the data. And if you compute this aspherical prefactor just by taking the data and dividing it by the spherical collapse theory, you will find this curve, which as predicted by the theory, does not depend on the redshift. So you'll find that pretty much all the redshifts, and also it does not depend on that much on the scale of the smoothing. And moreover, its slope and its amplitude are fixed by symmetries, which are the conservation of probability and translation invariance. So, okay, so far so good. Then we had also checked that this scaling is there even for very small cell radii. So went all the way to say 600 kiloparsecs, and still the scaling was there. So somehow the PDF at 600 kiloparsecs still knows about spherical collapse, linear theory, and these kind of things, which we found very impressive, given that in linear theory, we had to, sorry, in perturbation theory, we had to stop at 10 megaparsecs, and there is no hope to extend the validity of perturbation theory beyond that.
Then so what does control then this shape? I mean, like, you know, you were saying that this is independent of like redshift and lots of things, you know, so what does control the shape?
Well, yeah, this shape is first of all, it's controlled by just by symmetries. I mean, the amplitude should be always one, and then the slope. It is a very like for a given cosmology, it does not depend like on all ratios to the same. Then it depends a little bit on the matter power spectrum as well.
Right. But then I'm surprised then that is not dependent on redshift, right? I mean, like, you know, like, so at high redshift, for example, smaller things are collapsing, which are probing a different part of the power spectrum.
Yeah, but this, you know, this spherical prefactor, it somehow it depends not so much on the cosmology, but more on the nonlinear coupling between just on the structure of nonlinear kernels. And that's why it will be similar on all scales. Similar to all redshifts.
I guess the point is that you have different redshifts, you probe different parts of this, but the curve is always the same because you just, I mean, I guess at lower redshift, you go to higher delta.
Different redshifts will only modify the spherical prefactor. So of course you're saying that, if I go to high redshift, then my PDF will become more like Gaussian. Yeah, that's true. So it more resemble the Gaussian bell, but still there will be this correction, even at very high redshifts. Mm-hmm. So this is the prediction kind of this theory that happened to be true. We had computed this spherical prefactor by a combination of numerical and analytical techniques. And we have found some good agreement. One important point is that during this calculation, we had found that we need to renormalize the density field. So we need to take into account the so-called counter terms. For instance, the one that we're normally discussing in the context of the matter power spectrum, the effective sound speed. So we also found this in our calculation. And as a consistent check, this sound speed needs to be the same as in the dark matter case. So I guess that our approach, let me outline several features of this. It's consistent in the sense that it allows you to do calculations, not only the exponential, but also compute next to linear order corrections and so on and so forth in a controlled fashion. Then all the symmetries like the conservation of probabilities and translation variance, they are manifestly retained by the formalism. And then this approach has made several predictions like the semi-classical scaling, the shape of the prefactor, its cosmology dependence, the presence, the sensitivity to the dark matter sound speed. And all of these predictions have been verified in simulations. Also, it does even more than that. It predicts some average profiles of cosmic density. And this we have also found in simulations. Well, anyway, I'm running out of time, but let me just say that we briefly looked at what can be done at the level of data analysis. And right now it seems that the PDF can improve the power spectra only measurements. So there are already papers that some future forecasts, and now we're looking already at the level of the data. Well, by data, I mean simulations. That even in simulations, first of all, it seems that it's true that we measure the same dark matter sound speed. And second of all, the degeneracy orientation is very orthogonal to what we have in the power spectrum. So there is expectation that this probe will be also an important complement to the standard analysis. But here one important aspect is the covariance matrix because the PDF is more correlated. So different delta beans are correlated. So the accurate covariance matrix is required. And one important concern is the following. And we know that again, in linear theory, there is no extra information beyond the matter power spectrum. So the two things should coincide. So all the information that you get is some extra due to nonlinearities. And we know that these nonlinearities, they make life complicated. And for instance, they modify the covariance matrix and so on and so forth. But also this higher order cumulants, they contribute a lot to the tails. And in the tails, there is not so much signal to noise. So mostly, like we're expecting to get all the signal around the maximum of the PDF, which is we're studying now and where we need our covariance to be accurate. All right, so I guess I'm done with the main part of my talk. I'm running out of time, so you can just see the summary of my slides here. And that's it. Thank you.
Okay, great. Thanks very much, Misha. Let's all give a round of applause. Mm. Okay, Ashley, yeah, perfect timing even. Okay, so are there any further questions for the speaker? You can all just jump in, or if you want, you can raise your hand. Either way is fine. Maybe I can start off. For the last thing you mentioned about, yeah, you know, the PDF, so if I wanted now to extend this to like actual tracers like galaxies, presumably then my bias model will affect, you know, this PDF of like the density, right? So how do you plan to deal with that?
Well, correct way would be to get some fully nonlinear bias model and implement it, if it was possible to have this model analytically. But right now, I think that what we're planning to do is to use some start with some simple models, like the local collapse of matter. Yeah, it's true that all these calculations so far have been done only for dark matter, and of course, red space distortions and bias traceable add more complications. And unfortunately, we need to do it fully, like at the fully nonlinear level, right? Because the whole point of this PDF is that everything is very nonlinear, non-perturbative. I think an alternative way would be maybe to extract this analytic description in the form of the fit, to have some fit, say, between the delta galaxy and delta nonlinear, that would also be some fully nonlinear fit, and use it in the calculation.
Yeah, I see.
Like, again, from simulations.
Yeah, I understand. Okay. All right, thank you. Okay, so Alex, I think, had his hand raised first. So go ahead, Alex, you can unmute yourself.
So I think recently I've seen some claims from HSC and DES that they had trouble fitting perturbation theory models to weak lensing observables. So is this something that you've been thinking about? I mean, do you know kind of, or do you have an idea what might be going on there?
Yes. I know the papers that you're talking about. I think the problem, the difference with weak lensing observables is that ultimately you want to push to very short scales where perturbation theory is not well controlled. So perturbation theory is great on the nonlinear scales, where it can provide very good accuracy, but if you want to push it at things like, for instance, like Kmax 1 h or megaparsec, I think it's not under control at all. And they pointed this out, that somehow Hellofit is better on these scales, which is true, right? Because like Hellofit is exactly the fit of the matter power spectra on those short scales. So we're thinking that possible way out. Yeah, there are two options. First of all, you can use like a hybrid model that is like perturbation theory on nonlinear scales, on large scales, say up to 20 megaparsecs. And then for scales shorter than that, you use something like the emulator, you use a fit to simulations. Well, it's good to have the separation, because then you can calibrate your fit, only using the simulations from these short scales. So I think that this one option, and the second option is that you can use perturbation theory and to add some theoretical error to correct the perturbation theory for the mistake that it makes at this high case, because of course part of the signal it will describe correctly. So the problem with DS, is that they want to use the data cut something like 4 megaparsecs over h, whereas we know perturbation theory ultimately breaks down like at 20. Yeah, but in principle, we can do something by using these hybrid methods. So does it answer your question?
Oh yeah, thanks. Yes.
Okay,
yes, that's great.
Thank you.
Okay. Any further questions? I mean, Will, just jump in.
Can I ask your post-recon BAO fits? Very, very interesting. Your offsets with the standard approach seem larger than we've been getting in tests on mocks. I wonder if you did anything slightly differently, or whether you tried to optimize the method of having a damp BAO coupled with a smooth fit at all?
Well, here I just repeated the standard method. I was marginalizing over the broadband, and I was using this like P Viglia times the exponential damping. I think that the shift is larger than what we get. I mean, here it's maybe more explicit just because the volume of the simulation is very large. So it's like 600 gigaparsecs over H. So the scales were like 0.5%. I think it's known that at 0.5% level, say there is a shift of the BAO peak that is produced by nonlinearities. Right now, we don't need to worry about this. But in principle, reconstruction doesn't fully remove it, right? So there will be some residual that we need to model. So I think that just I'm observing exactly these nonlinear effects that are small for current service, but it seems that sure. For future service, they may become important.
Yeah, I was just intrigued. We were getting like 0.3% maximum offsets. So you just seemed a little bit larger than that, but that's probably in the details, as you say.
Yeah, but other than that, yeah, I'm just using the standard method, the same exact model as before.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay, any more questions?
Yeah, I guess I had kind of a question I've been trying to think about in my own head, but I'd be interested in your opinion, Michel. So in this step of doing the data compression, I guess you try and identify the parameters in your model that you most care about and try and project your data onto the subspace that most cares about those parameters. Is that the idea?
Right, yeah.
So now, if you think you might have leftover systematics in your data, or you might have nuisance parameters, though that might be more difficult to examine in this projected space, but it might be easier to examine than the full space where you just have bins. Is there like a halfway point where you can try and incorporate, I guess, like retain more modes which might be sensitive to leftover systematics so that you can examine those in the compressed basis? Or do you have any ideas about this?
Yeah, that's a great point. I think that some of the systematics we need to model, right? For instance, in the context of BOS, we're modeling fiber collisions, and ultimately the fiber collisions are also producing some extra shapes. So right now in the analysis, we're also kind of varying the parameters that are responsible for fiber collisions. So it means that in this basis of singular values, you will retain the sensitivity to this inaccuracies, and still, like, even if the smaller basis of coefficients, you will have to marginalize over them. But you're saying that in principle there is something that, like, we don't even model correctly, and something like there is some systematic effect, for instance this tensorial assembly bias, that still will survive or could even be amplified after the compression. Is it right? Is that your concern?
Well, I just had a general concern. Yeah, you can think about systematics where you might know they exist, but you can parameterize them. And then you might also have systematics that you don't know about before. I guess for the second case, you would probably want to look at the data in the unprojected basis. But then if you have some prior information about what systematics you might expect, then yeah, it's interesting to hear your approach where you just essentially put those in as extra parameters and make sure you keep modes that are sensitive to those parameters.
Yeah, I think this is what I would do, because I think that the method itself is kind of agnostic about this extra systematics.
Right. Okay. So thanks.
Okay. So in the interest of time, let's stop here. So our speaker will stay on Zoom, I think, for like the rest of the day, more or less. And so if you have further questions, you can bug him on Zoom. So let's thank him again for his great talk.